Psycho killer indeed. John Wayne Gacy was an American serial killer, also known as the Killer Clown. He molested and murdered 33 teenage boys and young men that we know of between 1972 and 1978. Gacy then buried 26 of his victims in the crawl space of his home and three others elsewhere on his property, discarding the remaining four victims in a nearby river. Gacy became known as the Killer Clown due to his charitable services at fundraising events, parades, and children's parties, where he would dress as Pogo the Clown, a character he devised himself. What you're going to hear over the next several hours on Coast to Coast AM is behind the mind of John Wayne Gacy. John Wayne Gacy defending a monster. We're going to be talking with his lawyer, Judge Sam Amarante, and also another attorney and co-author of this book, Danny Broderick. We'll be back with them in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. Let me introduce you to our guests. Judge Sam Amarante is a retired judge, current lawyer with his own law firm, Sam Amarante Associates. And in 1978, his first case after leaving the office of the public defender was the people of the state of Illinois versus John Wayne Gacy. He also authored the procedures adopted by the Illinois General Assembly as the Missing Child Act of 1984, which eliminated the 24-hour waiting period to initiate an immediate search for lost children. And also Danny Broderick, former associate attorney with the law firm of Amarante. And in 1988, Broderick founded his own law firm, of course, with his own name. During his 20 years of private practice, Mr. Broderick represented thousands of people charged with felony and misdemeanor crimes. We're going to talk about John Wayne Gacy, the mindset of serial killers, what it's like to be an attorney to these kinds of people. And here they are. First, let's bring in the judge, and let's bring in Danny as well. Sam, welcome to the show. How are you, sir?
Thank you, George. How are you?
My pleasure. Looking forward to this. And Danny, you're with us, too?
Yes, I am. How you doing?
Good. Good to have you both here. Let's talk for just a minute. First of all, your jobs as attorney. So many people will send emails to me and other people screaming and yelling because you folks try to get these people off, try to get them, acquitted. Tell me, Sam, what it's like to be a lawyer. You have to. That's your job. That's your creed. But what's it like to work? And maybe your gut tells you, I think this guy killed all these people.
Well, you know, it is our job. It is our creed. It's our passion when we do that. And when we defend somebody, and a lot of those people who call in or send the emails to you are people who may at one time or another need an attorney, whether it's on a traffic ticket or a DUI or a suspended license or another kind of case. And, you know, at that point, nobody cares, you know, what the lawyer thinks. It's just that you want somebody to represent you and basically someone to try to get you off of whatever you're charged with. And it's a passion. It's what we do. When we go into court, we defend not only that person, that individual person, but we defend and protect the Constitution of the United States. The Constitution that says every person, not even every citizen, but every person in this country carries that mantle of protection. And among those rights is your right to an attorney, but not only an attorney, a competent attorney. The case law has said, you have a right to counsel, but not only that, a competent lawyer. And a lawyer who doesn't do his best job for a client, regardless of what that client is accused of doing, is not doing their job. And that lawyer will be called on that in the appellate process in our country. That happened in a serial killer case, Juan Corona, out in California.
Oh, yeah.
Reversed. There were like 20-some murders, and it was reversed because the lawyer was more interested at the time in writing books for himself and movie rights and everything else. Didn't care about his client, didn't do anything for his client. His client was convicted, and the Supreme Court reversed that and said, no, I don't care if this is a serial killer or not. The lawyer has to do his job. So there's a built-in safeguard in our system, and when somebody comes in our office, it's irrelevant to our representation as to what they've been accused of doing because they're presumed innocent. The facts could be there. They, in fact, could have done what they're accused of doing. But there's various defenses that can be imposed, and that's our job, and that's what we do, and we live and breathe that. We take an oath to do that, and that's how we handle it.
If you suspect that someone's guilty, based on the fact that maybe he told you, you still have to defend him. But how do you feel about that personally, Sam? I mean, does it Does it bother you? Can you go home and forget about it until the trial, or is it something that eats away at you?
George, if I only had to defend innocent people, I wouldn't have a law practice.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, everybody who comes in, I suspect as a person, even though under the law they're presumed to be innocent of the charge, as a person, like any other person, I certainly suspect that they committed the crime that they're accused of committing. Police do make mistakes, and they do arrest innocent people. But most of the time, they don't make mistakes. And most of the time, when people walk into a lawyer's office, they probably did what they're accused of doing. And if they are convicted, it's, you know, we have so many safeguards in our system. The right to be presumed innocent until proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. The right to question the witnesses who testify against you. The right to bring in your own witnesses. The right to remain silent. The right to have a jury of 12 people of your peers. All those rights are there. And so chances are, if somebody is convicted with all those rights, and if all those rights are properly protected, chances are they're guilty. But when they walk in your office, that guilt isn't there, because guilt is a legal conclusion that's decided in a court of law. Not in a lawyer's office, not on the TV, not on the radio, not in a newspaper, not in a street corner, not in a bar. It's decided in a court of law. And we have the greatest system in the world because it protects the innocent. People think that it protects the guilty. It protects the innocent, because if all those rights are properly enforced and the person is innocent, chances are they shouldn't be found guilty. And unfortunately, it does happen sometimes. And it happens because a defense lawyer doesn't do his job or her job. That's why it happens.
Let's bring in Danny. Danny, you wrote this book with Sam. Gacy was killed by lethal injection, almost a botched lethal injection, 17 years ago. What took you to so long to write this story?
Well, there have actually been a few attempts to get this book written. I like to think that it's the mixing of Sam and I. I was able to write this book in first person because I've known Sam for 25 years. I know him well. I know pretty much how he thinks. We worked together for a period of time. And that allowed me to kind of speak in his voice. And it was just time. It was time to tell the story. Any previous efforts were unsuccessful. There were some attempts to have different writers write this, and those writers did not understand what Sam was just talking about. They did not understand that every person is presumed innocent, and they were writing the story as if Sam should apologize for what he did. Sam never apologized for representing John Wayne Gacy, nor should he, okay, because everyone, including the John Gacys of the world, have this right to a trial and a right to be proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. I feel the exact same way. So when I started writing this story, I wrote it in a voice where we both agree, and it just worked. It just worked for both of us.
Do you, as an attorney, do you have the right to turn down a client if you don't want to represent him? And I'm not saying public defender, but some guy comes in and says, look, I've just been accused of killing my wife, and you know what? I need you to represent me. Can you tell him, sorry, I'm not going to, for whatever reason, but can you reject that?
The answer is yes, you can. But if you turn down everybody that came into your office that was guilty or you know, that did it, you wouldn't have any business.
And you know what, George, I think a lawyer does that, and you do have the right. Of course you have the right to reject the client. And sometimes you do, but not because of what they've done, but because of a personality conflict or because they're trying to run the show rather than you, the lawyer, and make the decisions. And that's the reason I would reject the case. But a lawyer would reject the case just because it's unpopular. And I'll tell the lawyers who are listening out there, they shouldn't do that. I think that's wrong. I think it violates our oath as a lawyer, because lawyers are supposed to take on not only popular causes, but unpopular causes. That's what lawyers do. And if they don't do that, they're not really being true to the oath of being a lawyer, especially a criminal lawyer. Now, if they don't want to do that, maybe they, you know, could practice some other kind of law, some civil law. And even in civil cases, they're going to run one of the clients they don't like. But a lawyer shouldn't make the decision based upon what somebody is accused of doing, because that really perverts the oath that we take. You know, and I just want to mention, I know there's probably a lot of ex-servicemen or maybe current servicemen and women out there. And, you know, I served in the Marine Corps. Danny served in the Army. And
I was in the Navy, so we almost got it all covered.
Yeah, we do. We don't have a Navy. My dad was in the Navy. But, you know, it's just that so many men and women have died and given up their life, their limbs, and their health, and their wealth, and everything else to defend what we have in this country. And when a lawyer goes in court and protects those rights, he is serving, he's putting honor in what they've done, because those people have given up so much more than all of us give up every day to keep those rights. And if a lawyer does pervert that that duty that a lawyer has, I think he's really not doing his job, or she's not doing her job.
Would you have defended, for example, had they arrested Osama bin Laden, brought him to this country, and he needed counsel, and it stumbled into you? I mean, would you have represented him? I guess you have to.
All right, the last time I got a question like that was during a Gacy case. Somebody asked me about Hitler, and my answer was yes, I would. And Osama bin Laden, as much as I hate him, and, you know, I'd like to, you know, I would like to have strangled him with everybody else, and I was joyful when he was killed. As a person, you know, watching my TV, and as a normal human being, but as a lawyer, if he came in and asked me to represent him, I would represent him as vigorously as I would and zealously as I would any other client, because he would be my client. And if I was the most unpopular man in the whole world for doing it, I would have to do it again, because I would not want to have all of those men and women, and, you know, 30 of them we just lost who were on that Navy SEAL team that got bin Laden. I don't want those guys to have died in vain in protecting what we have in our Constitution and our wonderful country, and not do my job as a lawyer. It just wouldn't be right. It'd be, you know, I use an example of a physician a lot. If I were a physician and bin Laden was shot almost to death, and he went into the emergency room instead of be dead, and there was a physician there to take care of him, would think anybody would ask the physician, why would you try to save his life when you let him die?
No.
Everybody knows a physician.
A physician would do what he had to. I might slip with a scalpel a little bit, but...
Could happen, you know, if you...
The truth is, nobody questions that. Nobody questions. Nobody says to a doctor, how can you work on that scumbag? They do, in fact, question lawyers, how can you represent this scumbag? Well, the system that we have does rely on precedent. So say, for example, a Gacy walks into your office and you you don't do your best job. Or you go along with what other people say, and they say, this guy does not deserve a trial.
Right.
Because he killed 33 men and boys. So we don't give Gacy a trial. Well, the next lawyer that is representing somebody who killed 12 people is going to come in and say, this is just as bad as when we didn't give Gacy a trial. Yes, Gacy killed 33. This guy killed 12. So it's terrible. So pretty soon you've got it down to 12. And slowly but surely, with the use of precedent, you can actually, in theory, see how you could reduce it continuously down till all of a sudden nobody charged with murder would be able to have his day in court. And then, to take it to an extraordinary level, it could start going down past murder, people charged with other crimes, because this is so horrendous and that is so horrendous. This country, at one time, used to put witches in water to see if they would float.
Yeah, we've had
a lot of different variations on our system, and this is the one that we've come up with. And because it's working fairly well, better than most countries, as defense lawyers, we feel like we're wearing the white hat when we walk into court representing a guy, because we're representing the Constitution.
We're going to dissect the John Wayne Gacy case with both of you tonight as extensively as we can. But I think, Sam, you tried to cop the plea of insanity when you were representing him. Why did they take that? Obviously, the guy was whacked out.
You're absolutely right. And if we looked at the evidence purely, and if it was put into a computer, I mean, there's no doubt that he should have been found not guilty by reason of insanity. He was absolutely whacked out. It was a very simple issue in the trial, in the case. The prosecution argued he was evil, and we argued he was insane.
He was insane and possibly evil, I guess,
right? And insanely evil. And, yeah. And they said he was born evil, and they said that he knew what he was doing, and he was psychopathic or sociopathic. And under Illinois law, at least, most jurisdictions, that is not considered insanity. Insanity was defined as if you do something that you can't control, that you you cannot conform your conduct because of a mental illness, you cannot conform your conduct to the requirements of law or appreciate the criminality of your act. And we argue that Gacy had a mental illness, and based upon that mental illness, he could not appreciate the criminality of his act, or he could not conform his conduct to the requirements of law. Their argument was, well, yes, he could, because even though he was crazy, even though he was abnormal, and I think Terry Sullivan and Bill Kunkel really brought that forth in their closing arguments, even though he was abnormal, he still knew what he was doing. And he could conform his conduct, because otherwise he would have done it in public. He wouldn't have hidden his victims.
And buried them and everything else, yeah.
Right, yeah, like Hinckley when he shot President Reagan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was the classic insanity defense, because he did it in front of the whole world.
Yeah.
Baker was watching. He went to impress Jodie Foster, and the whole world was watching him. And because of his neurosis, his obsessive compulsive disorder, he shot the president. And that is classic insanity, because he, Hinckley, could not conform his conduct to the requirements of law, and he did not appreciate the criminality of his act because of his neurotic mental illness. And therefore, he was found not guilty by reason of insanity and put in a mental institution. Now, we felt Gacy, of course, fell in that same category, but the prosecution successfully argued that, no, this guy was just evil. He was crazy, but he understood what he was doing, and he hid those bodies because he knew what he was doing. And that was really the issue in the case, and we lost. You know, once the issue of insanity is raised, the government or the state has the burden of proving the person sane beyond a reasonable doubt. And if we look back at the evidence and the arguments, I don't think that happened in the Gacy case. But if you're sitting on a jury, what are you going to do?
Yeah, exactly. And it was so explosive. Yeah. How did John Wayne Gacy come to you as a client, Sam? How did that happen?
Well, it's actually on the book there, George. That's what the book's about.
Yeah, but it sounds better if you say it.
Yeah, I was just leaving the public defender's office in Cook County. I'd been with them for 4.5 years. I was a supervisor in the northwest suburban area of Chicago, and I decided to go into private practice, hang up a shingle, and I went in with a couple other lawyers I knew. And Gacy, at the same time, was being tailed by the Des Plaines police. I was in my new office, and Gacy, who had known me from a local political organization here, he was a precinct captain. And kind of, you know, political wannabe, kind of a blowhard guy. And he knew everybody, and everybody knew Gacy. And he called, he knew I was the chief public defender out there in the Des Plaines Police Department. Our offices were in the same building. And he figured I knew the police who were tailing him from the village or city of Des Plaines, Illinois. And he called my office looking for me, figuring I would know something, because he was a clout guy. He was somebody who was looking for influence, sort of like our former governor, Blagojevich, who was just convicted.
Yeah.
But he called the office looking for me, and my secretary at the time called me in the new office I had just opened and said, Sam, there's a guy named John Gacy called looking for you. Do you know him? I said, yeah, I know who he is. She said, can I give him your new number? Where are you at? I said, sure, give him my number. I'm here. Gave him the number, and he calls and says, hi, Sam, how you doing? I said, how you doing, John? He said, can you do me a favor? I said, sure, no problem. What's the problem? He said, can you find out why I'm being tailed by Des Plaines Police Department? They're all over my ass, and I can't shake them, and they're ruining my business. I don't know what's going on. Can you find out? I said, hey, John, sure. I know all those guys. You know, they're friends of mine. I've had a lot of cases with them. I know the chief over there. I know the mayor. I'll find out.
Hold the story right there, Sam. We're coming up to a break. I want to come right back to this. Our special guest tonight, Judge Sam Amirante and Danny Broderick. We're talking about their work, John Wayne Gacy, Defending a Monster. More to come on Coast to Coast AM. Well, for less than 25 cents a day, you can become a Coast Insider. We had our video chat tonight. Went very, very well. We had a surprise guest in there. Dr. Roger Lear popped in to talk about his work, and it was pretty fun. We're going to come back in just a moment as we talk more about the mind of John Wayne Gacy, Defending a Monster, on Coast to Coast AM. And we're with Danny Broderick and Sam Amirante as we talk about the life of John Wayne Gacy with their work, John Wayne Gacy, Defending a Monster. All right, Sam, you were talking about how you and John Wayne Gacy got together as attorney-client, and go ahead.
Yeah, well, I know him. You know, I tell you, he was an acquaintance through the political party out there, a local political party, and he was a commissioner in our lighting district. Anyway, he knew me, so he called and said, can I do me a favor? I said, sure, as I would anybody. George, if you call me tomorrow and says, hey, Sam, can you help me out? Can you do me a favor? I'd say, sure.
Yeah.
George, you know, what do you need? That's basically how it was, and I had no idea what was to come. You know, he said, find out what they're tailing me. So I did it. I went over to the police I knew and asked them, and none of them would say anything. I went to the police chief of the department. He wouldn't say anything to me. I went to see the mayor of Des Plaines. He wouldn't say anything other than, you know, it's a bad guy. Gacy's a bad guy. I go, oh, come on. He's a good guy. The guy's a clown. He puts these big parties on. He's a precinct captain. They give me a break. You know, you're tailing him, and the guy didn't do anything wrong. No. We have some missing kid. We think he did it. And I said, what, a missing kid? What are you talking about? I went to Terry Sullivan, and he was the chief prosecutor out in the district there.
Okay.
And he wouldn't tell me anything. Then I sent my secret weapon out. I had a secretary who could get information from anybody, George.
Okay.
Any kind of case I had, she knew every policeman in the whole northwest suburban area. If I had to know somebody, so I sent her out to find out. And nobody would tell her. So when I knew nobody would tell her anything, I knew something big was going on, but I had no idea. And he kept giving me the same old garbage all the time that, because I asked him about a missing kid, and there was a pharmacy involved. And he said, yeah, he had been in that pharmacy. He didn't even see a kid. And he said, then he may have seen a kid, but he had nothing to do with it. And the police were just harassing him. And then he went up telling me about I said, why would they be chasing you? And he said, he had no idea. Then Terry Sullivan told me that Gacy had been convicted of sodomy in Waterloo, Iowa, back in 1968. And
served a little time, right?
And served time, 10 years, which I'll tell you, just a little side note, this is kind of an indictment on our criminal justice system, because he got a 10-year sentence. And almost 10 years to the day after he was sentenced, he killed his last victim.
Jeez.
And had he served his entire sentence, none of those kids would have been killed by Gacy's hand, at least. I don't know what fate would have dealt them.
Yeah,
but they wouldn't have been killed by Gacy. And he only served a little over a year of that sentence, and he was released because he was a model prisoner. He was a model prisoner, and he was a con man. Gacy was the consummate con man. He was very intelligent. He had about 160 IQ. He was a master manipulator, and he was actually able to manipulate and con his way to a very early release in jail, and he was a model prisoner when he was there. And then he went on, you know, a few years later, he went on that killing spree. But, you know, and I found out about the Waterloo, Iowa thing. I confronted him, and he said, oh, it was just some little misdemeanor-type thing. It was called sodomy of films, which then I really wondered, because there's no such thing as sodomy of films. I said, you know, there's nothing in Illinois, and I checked Iowa law, and there was nothing in Iowa on sodomy of films. But I let him go with it.
Okay.
And, you know, slowly I started suspecting that he may have had something to do with this kid, but I just didn't want to believe it, because the way this guy presented himself was that, like, somebody everybody liked. You know, he wasn't the Brian Dennehy played him in some terrible movie they made one time. And I loved Brian Dennehy.
Right, he's a great actor.
But he's not John Gacy. Yeah. Gacy was not a big, tough, strong guy that would intimidate anybody. He was like a chubby Santa Claus kind of guy. You know, that's what he looked like, and he certainly wouldn't scare you if you saw him or talked to him. He was more like a salesman, like a car salesman, you know. And so, you know, that was the impression I had of John Gacy, and I wanted to think that the guy was just in a wrong place at the wrong time, and he was being picked on just because he had this prior case in Iowa, and he really didn't want to come forward with it to me, which isn't unusual in a client.
And they might not have had a lot of suspects, so there he was.
Right, and there he was in the wrong place, and it happens. He was in the wrong place at the wrong time. And that was my position. And I got to the point where I threatened, not only threatened, but prepared a federal lawsuit against the city of Des Plaines and the police officers for harassing him, for violating his civil rights, for tailing him. And that lawsuit was filed. In the meantime, I had set up Gacy with a polygraph because I wanted to believe what he was saying, but I wanted to be sure. And that was for my own use, not for anybody's use, but my own use. But before we were able to give him the polygraph, and this is after a number of days had gone by, and I hadn't slept for days. I had my my older son was in the hospital at the time, and we were up all night with him, and his investigation was going on. It was getting more and more intense, and anyway, he called me one night, and this is after all the crap he had given me over and over again, and telling me that he had nothing to do with it, and blah, 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 the same old story over and over again. And he called me and said, Sam, I really have to talk to you. Something new I have to tell you. It's really important. And I said, John, look, I'm tired of your crap. I don't want to hear anything else from you. If you're going to give me the same old stuff, I'm with my son here. I haven't slept in days. I don't want to hear it. He goes, no,
yeah,
please.
You were at wit's end.
Yeah, meet me at your office. And it was cold. It's cold, snowy, icy Chicago December. And I said, all right, if it's something new, I'll meet you at my office. So we got a hold of his other lawyer at the time, Leroy Stevens, who was a civil attorney for his construction company.
Okay.
And we met at my office, and his tails followed him. One guy we actually saw tonight, we had a book signing tonight. We saw Mike Albrecht, one of the police officers. He was there. And in his tails, you know, including Mike, followed him to my office, and we met him out there. And we go in the office, and George, he said the same old crap again to me. He was in the price of John.
Over and over.
Over. I see you called me out here in the middle, you know, late at night. I'm tired. My kid's in a hospital. I don't want to hear this garbage from you, okay? And I don't know if I could say other words.
But, well, the garbage is good.
Okay. And I said, I don't want to hear this. And I start screaming at him in my Italian volatile way. I start pounding on the table in front of him. And I had a newspaper, which was our local suburban paper, the Daily Herald. And Robbie Peast, the missing boy, the last victim's picture was in front of the paper. And I'm pointing at the picture, and I'm pounding on the table. I said, John, this kid is missing. He's a good kid. His mother went to pick him up at the pharmacy that night. He disappeared. You were in that pharmacy. I think you're lying to me. I want to know the truth. Tell me the truth. And he looked at me, eyeball to eyeball, no more than a few feet away from me, across the table. He says, Sam, and I kind of lose my breath now when I'm talking about this. Sam, I've been a judge, jury, and executioner of many. No, I take that back. It's not the first thing he said. He looked at the picture in the paper that I showed him, and he said, Sam, this boy is not the boy that was in the drugstore, but this boy's dead. He's in the Des Plaines River.
Oh,
oh man, George, my heart starts pounding. Pounding.
You must feel so weird at that time.
It was just
sickening.
Horrid. And just about one at the time. And then he looked at me. He says, do you have anything to drink? And I happen to have a bottle of VO in my car that I got as a Christmas present from one of my former investigators. I said, you know what? I have a bottle in the car. I ran out to the car. The police officers were out there in their car, their junky old car, sitting there watching the office. I grabbed the bottle of VO, and I saw them. They're shivering. Their car was off and was cold. I said, you guys, I got a feeling it's going to be a long night. If you want to come and sit in the hallway of the office building there, be my guest, have some coffee if you want to drink. It's not we don't want to drink, but I said, come out in there and keep warm. They went in. I went into my office with the bottle, took these. Remember these old plastic coffee cups shaped like a funnel?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay, I had those, and I poured a little shot in each one, and Gacy said, no, fill it up. So I filled it up, and I had a shot. Leroy had a shot. Gacy gulped the whole thing down. He said, can I have another cup? Filled the whole cup up again, gulped it down again. Then he looked at me, eyeball to eyeball, and he said, I've been the judge, jury, and executioner of many, many people. Now I want to be my own judge, jury, and executioner. I don't want you to interfere. I don't want you to interrupt me. I don't want you to do anything. I'm going to do everything my own way, and I just want you to listen to me. I said, what the hell are you talking about? And honest to God, it was aging as minutes were going by.
Yeah.
At that point in time, he started talking. He said it began in 1972. He said he was cruising around or in the area of the Greyhound bus station in downtown Chicago. And some kid came off a bus and looked like he was lost. And he asked him if he needed a ride. And he gave the kid a ride. He said the kid turned out to be a male prostitute. And he took him home with him. And they had, you have to understand, I thought Gacy was straight. I had no idea. You know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I was just, like, dumbfounded.
Right. And you don't have to be too graphic. You know?
Oh, it was just the rest of the night for hours, longer than your show lasts.
Yeah.
It was hours he described every murder, and it is graphically, you know, described in the.
Was he shaking? Was he nervous?
He appeared to be high and drunk and shaky, but very matter of fact. He was very monotone, very matter of fact, very specifically describing each and every murder. He remembered some of the names. He remembered some of the dates. He remembered the times of year. He remembered where he picked these kids up. He remembered how many he killed. One time he killed three at one time.
Do you think he wanted to stop?
Yes, I do. I really, truly believe that. There was another killer in Illinois at one time. His name was William Ahrens. And there was a book about him, and it was called Stop Me Before I Kill Again. And I really think that's how Gacy felt, sort of like the Jekyll and Hyde character, where he had such a good part. When Gacy was good, he was the best of good. He was a wonderful, compassionate human being when he was good. When he was bad, he was the worst of evil. And he had a split, an absolute split in his personality. And that evil was taking over more and more. The murders were becoming more and more frequent as time came on. And then the last kid, he changed his M.O. I mean, he snatched this kid right out of a drugstore. He hadn't done that before. And then he was playing games with the police who were tailing him. He was saying clowns could get away with murder and come on into my house. And he unplugged the sump pump, and a smell came up from the base, from the crawl space. And I really think he wanted to get caught. I really think he wanted the killing to stop, and he didn't know how to do it. So like most serial killers do, he played cat and mouse games with the police. He tried to outsmart them. He wanted them to outsmart him. He tried to outfox them. He wanted them to try to outfox him. And he played these games. But in short, to answer your question, I really believe he wanted to get caught. He wanted it to be over. He just didn't know how he wanted it to
be. He had been married a couple times, right?
Twice.
Yeah.
He was married back in Waterloo, Iowa, and he actually had a couple of children in that marriage.
And I guess they're still around somewhere, right?
Somewhere. And he had a stepchildren with his second marriage, a stepchild who adored him. The kids in his second marriage adored him. They thought he was the most wonderful man in the world. His wife adored him. And when she left him, he was sitting in a bar one time with her, and they were out and having a good time, and he asked her, he said, "What kind of guys do you like?" And she said, "What do you mean, John? I like you. I'm married to you. I love you. You know, what do you mean, what kind of guys do I like?" And he said, "What type of guy do you like?" She said, "I like you." He goes, "No, for instance, let me tell you." He says, "I like that guy." He says, I like the butt on that guy over there. I like him." And she's like, "What are you talking about, John?" And he tried to tell her that he was, what he called bisexual, but he really was homosexual.
Right, right.
He was a homophobic homosexual. And again, that was one of his dichotomies. He had so many dichotomies, Gacy. He thought he had an upside down heart that caused these weird heart conditions and situations that he had, which didn't exist physiologically. It didn't exist. But he thought he had all this stuff. And that's what.
Let me ask you this, only because I'm curious. And if this is something you can't talk about, tell me. Did he end up ever paying you? I mean, this must have been an expensive trial.
Oh yeah. Well, he gave me gave us at the time a $3,000 retainer, which is all the money he had in the bank. Right before he was going to get, I think it was right that night. That night he wrote a check for $3,000,
which is nothing nowadays for legal fees. You know
nothing
that.
Then you know
it wasn't that much then either.
Yeah. You know, we didn't think it was going to be that big, but ultimately Judge Lou Garippo appointed us because it was a capital case, and he wanted us to represent him, and he had a right to have a lawyer of his choice. So we got appointed, and we were paid by the
state
county.
Okay. All right. I was figuring how he did that because he didn't have any money.
Yeah, and we were paid the public defender as a public defender, basically, for the next 15 months.
There's no doubt that with what I've read about this case, his father screwed him up.
Yeah, so, you know, and I hate to say that because, you know, his sister, and she may be listening to the show, one sister is still alive, and, you know, she loved her father very much, and his mother adored their father. Dad was a tough old Polish blue-collar worker, okay? You know, my dad was a tough Italian blue-collar worker. He drove a newspaper truck, and he was tough on me.
But not mean.
No,
there's a difference.
Mean. I knew he loved it. I knew he loved me, and he loved me all the time, no matter how tough he was on me. And that I think, is the difference. I don't think John ever believed his dad loved him. I think John always thought that his dad thought he was a failure. And his dad, you know, and Danny might be able to answer that question better than I could even, because he's really done a lot of research on it.
Well, didn't his father, Dan, always put him down?
Always. And I have to ask, what do you think the expectations of a man who names his son John Wayne?
Yeah.
I mean, that's really what happened here. People call John Wayne Gacy Jr. John Wayne Gacy Jr. He wasn't a junior. His father's name was John Stanley Gacy. So without being too critical, you know, there are living relatives, et cetera. Yes, he put him down, and John Wayne Gacy spent most of his life trying to, gain the love that he could never get from his father, because here's a guy that named his kid John Wayne, okay? He expected certain things, you would think, and what he got was an uncoordinated, chubby, sort of outcast kid who played mostly with his sisters. Some would say, you know, especially nowadays, some would say that's fine. Back then, that was looked upon as bad, and some of the terms that are in the book were specific to his father. He would call his son a fruit picker, he would call him a sissy, etc. And we know nowadays there's all kinds of efforts to try to stop bullying. We know nowadays what that can do to a kid.
Absolutely. Did he have the M.O. as a kid? I mean, did he kill animals or anything like that?
No, you know, he really wasn't a mean kid. As Danny was saying, he was somewhat effeminate and a gentle kid. I mean, his sister, again, who's still alive, could tell you, John was really a gentle boy. He wasn't a mean kid. He wasn't a bully. If anything, he got bullied around by people, and he got bullied around by his dad. And ironically enough, his dad used to lock himself, he used to go drink heavily and lock himself in the basement. And John, when he was a little boy, stole his mom's underwear, her panties.
Yeah.
And he buried them under a porch, which was very similar to a crawl space, in almost the same pattern that he buried the bodies later on in life. And like Danny said, he wanted to please his dad so bad. His dad was this tough, hard-working guy, hard-drinking guy, and John was nothing like him. And he was his only son. John had two sisters, and he became very close with his sisters, and he related more with them than he did with his dad. And it really, really broke his heart when his dad died, because he had that conviction for sodomy. He was in jail when his dad died at Christmas in 1969, I think it was.
Yeah, Christmas Day, 1969.
And they wouldn't let him out for the funeral.
They wouldn't let him out. And so I think that was one of the things. Again, I talked about jail and letting him out, but, you know, sometimes there has to be a little compassion where, you know, you are even are in jail and something like that happens. Maybe, you know, it should be considered to be let go to see their relatives, because that is one of the triggers, I think, that caused the killing later on.
All right, hold on, you two. We're going to come back in just a moment. We're talking with Judge Sam Amberente and Danny Broderick, their work, John Wayne Gacy, Defending a Monster. And we're going to get deep into the mind of John Wayne Gacy when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. And if you need to email me, that's George@coasttocoastam.com.